Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why Brandeis Matters, this hour of the program. It's a series of very interesting articles in The New Republic, written by our guest this hour, who's currently writing a book on former Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Jeffrey Rosen is joining us. He is a professor of law at the George Washington University and the legal affairs editor of The New Republic. His most recent book is The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. He's also the author of The Most Democratic Branch, The Naked Crowd, and The Unwanted Gaze. His essays and commentaries have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, on National Public Radio, and in The New Yorker, where he has been a staff writer. The Chicago Tribune has named him one of the 10 best magazine journalists in America, and the LA Times called him the nation's most widely read and influential legal commentator. In part of this very long and extremely interesting article on Brandeis, he writes that Brandeis's reputation could rest alone on his analysis of corporate bigness, and he accomplished that before he joined the Supreme Court. On the bench, further distinction followed. Brandeis became the most far-seeing progressive justice of the 20th century, the one whose judicial philosophy is most relevant for the court today as it confronts questions involving regulation in a time of economic crisis and the preservation of constitutional liberty in a time of technological change. The judicial philosophy rested on three pillars, and we'll talk about those pillars during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, and thanks for that really nice introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome. This guy was a real thinker, and he was really cared about the good of all. There was this humanitarianism about him that makes him such an interesting person.
There really is. We think about justices as kind of cold figures, and it's so interesting to contrast Brandeis with other justices of his age. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who is his colleague, really met that standard of the cold justice who had contempt for the people, and he would uphold progressive laws, but he thought that he said, "I loathe the thick-fingered clowns we call the people." He had no real sympathy for the people whose laws that he was upholding. But Brandeis was the opposite. He was so optimistic, ultimately, that people in small communities could deliberate in a way that would elevate themselves and improve the country. And he was so moved by the strikes that he helped to mediate. He became a Zionist because he was impressed by the intelligence of the Russian immigrants, the Jewish immigrants, as part of a garment worker strike. He was mediating in New York City. He was an idealist, a romantic, a Jeffersonian, and he very much, as you say, had faith that with intelligence and commitment, people really could make a better country and a better life for themselves.
Mm. I always like to hear about people's backgrounds. Did that come from where he grew up? It was kind of this modest upbringing.
It was modest, although it wasn't a log cabin upbringing.
Right.
His parents came from Eastern Europe and Germany in the 1848 revolutions, and his father was a grain merchant based in Louisville, Kentucky, and he kind of went boom and bust. There were times when the Brandeises were pretty comfortable, and they certainly had pianos and music and European trips. But his father lost a lot of money in one of the depressions of the late 19th century, and Brandeis had to go abroad to Europe to study, where he became impressed by the importance of facts. But I think it was Brandeis's experience, seeing his father's clients wiped out in the depressions of the 1870s, that first kindled in him a tremendous opposition to the curse of bigness, a belief that banks, especially those based in the East, would be more concerned with profits for the managers than with the welfare of the depositors and the shareholders. And that was the beginning of the economic crisis that ripened into this economic philosophy that proved to be the most prescient progressive economic philosophy of his day.
Tell me about this Other People's Money and How Bankers Use It, the book that he published in 1914. A couple questions. You'll have to tell us what the essence of it was, but should it be required reading for all in 2010 as well?
You know, it really should. It's an astonishing read, and it's so relevant. He wrote this as a series of articles in Harper's Magazine initially, and it was in the wake of the crash of 1907, which kind of presaged the crash of 1929. And there was a series of congressional committees found to investigate the source of the crash. They were called the Pujo committees, after the chairman of the committee. And Brandeis wrote these series of essays trying to analyze how the crash had happened and how it could be prevented. He said the basic problem was the risks that bankers took with other people's money. And his villain was J.P. Morgan, the great banker. Morgan's power came not just from his own money, but from the volumes of other people's money that he controlled. And Brandeis talked about this oligarchical power where, without putting up any of the Morgan's own capital, they could use the deposits that they gained from other people, take reckless bets. If the bets went bad, the depositors and the shareholders would be wiped out, but the Morgan Bank would just triumph. He was very alert to the dangers of oligarchy and the interlocking directorates that allowed Morgan, by putting his own men on the boards of the railways that he controlled, essentially to ensure that the railways were built without concern for the passengers or for shareholders, but again, just for the bottom line for Morgan. And it was also in this book that Brandeis had another very memorable phrase, the curse of bigness. He was absolutely convinced that when you had these huge banks and huge railroads and trusts, the people who were controlling them couldn't understand the complexity of the risks that they were taking. It was beyond any one person to really know whether or not it was a good bet to invest in these huge, complicated mega firms. And Brandeis, throughout his life, believed that only small-scale businesses and small-scale government could be conducted on a humane enough scale for people to actually get their heads around it. It is the reason it should be required reading is because this book predicted not only the crash of 1929, which Brandeis literally predicted several years before it happened, but also the regulatory response to the crash that avoided another crash for more than 50 years, and then the crash of 2007. It's the same things that Brandeis worried about, the curse of bigness, the complexity of these new financial instruments, the credit default swaps and so forth that we now know that the investment banks had no clue about what the actual risks were when rating agencies overvalued the soundness of these bonds. Amazingly, it's the same parties in some cases. Morgan Stanley, the successor to the J.P. Morgan firm, was involved in the crash of 2007. And also the prescriptions that Brandeis insisted on, in particular the separation of commercial and investment banking, which was passed into law in the Glass-Steagall Act during the New Deal. It was the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the 1990s, and the fact that the commercial banks were able to make reckless bets for their own account that led to much of the risk-taking that led to the crash. So it's almost the entire financial history of the 20th century is encapsulated in this book, which is, to make it, to add icing on the cake, is an incredibly good read. I mean, he was a very talented phrase maker, and phrases like other people's money, the curse of bigness, and also sunlight is the best disinfectant. That came from that book, too. He said that what we really need, you know, if people knew the ridiculously large bonuses that these bankers were taking for themselves, the commissions that they were charging, then there'd be a public outcry and regulation would follow. It's a brilliant book.
I think you've just made it go again to the top of the New York Times bestseller list for this week. I'm ready. I'm going to go buy it. Did he share an equally deeply felt concern about big government?
He did, and that's what makes him such an interesting figure and hard to predict ideologically. He was not a top-down regulator, and he had problems with some aspects of the New Deal. He was on the Supreme Court at that time because he thought that the same curse of bigness would happen in government as in business, and that government regulators would be just as unable to understand complicated risks, would be captured by their constituents and by lobbyists, and would ultimately harm citizens. So Brandeis, another great phrase he came up with was the states as laboratories of democracy. He said a single state may, if it chooses, be a laboratory of democracy and come up with experimentation on a human scale. And that's why Brandeis's solution to the crash of 29 wasn't huge top-down federal regulation. He wanted to break up the banks, to tax them, so that they were small enough to be effectively regulated by the states. In that sense, he would not have liked all of the Obama financial reform bill. Rather than creating these new federal regulatory agencies, he would have preferred to break up the banks. And there, and the Brandeis of today, Paul Volcker, who really tried to argue for that, unfortunately lost that battle. And in the Obama administration, the sort of top-down Hamiltonian New Dealer types triumphed over the Brandeis, Jeffersonian, small is beautiful types.
Small is beautiful. Did he come up with that, too?
No, that wasn't his. But of course, that was mine, but it's not as good a phrase as the curse of pigness.
Tell us a little bit more about this Glass-Steagall Act. You write about how important it was, how it kept the number of bank failures in this country for 50 years to such a low. Tell me more about the intricacies of this act, his role in this act, and why in the world it was dismantled.
Glass-Steagall separated commercial and investment banking. It said that commercial banks can take deposits and engage in currency exchange, but if you want to engage in investment banks, issuing bonds and taking bets and basically trading on stocks, then you have to have a separate entity. After Glass-Steagall was passed, the J.P. Morgan Bank, Brandeis's nemesis, had to break itself up. The Morgan Bank itself remained as a commercial bank, but they created Morgan Stanley as the investment banking arm that would allow them to make trades in stocks. The reason this was very effective is because it was harder for the investment banks to take really reckless risks with other people's money when they didn't have an unlimited access to the deposits that were in the commercial banks. But in the 1990s, for some crazy reason that had to do with Phil Graham's anti-regulatory lobbying, the Clinton administration agreed to dismantle Glass-Steagall and to permit investment banks to make trades for their own account, which basically means making bets and selling stocks and bonds, not only for depositors, but for themselves. This gave them an almost unlimited pool of bets to take. They could borrow against their supposed earnings without being able to back up the value of those bonds, and that's how you had these crazy credit default swaps that were certified by the ratings agencies as being sound, whereas in fact their actual soundness was they were valueless because no one actually understood the instruments on which they were supposedly based. That was the main source of the crash of 2007, and in the current reform bill, although the Glass-Steagall separation of commercial and investment banking was not resurrected, unfortunately, there are leverage requirements that say that banks can't take bets with certain proportions of capital that would make things really dangerous. Unfortunately, the most important Brandeisian reform proposed by Paul Volcker and called by President Obama the Volcker Rule would prohibit banks from trading for their own accounts. Mm. And that was passed in a pretty watered-down form, and lots of people fear that it wasn't strong enough, really, to avoid the danger that we just saw. So I think, you know, Brandeis would have been modestly happy with some aspects of the bill, but overall he would have felt that it did not go far enough in breaking up the banks and prohibiting this proprietary trading and imposing tough leverage requirements. And I think he would fear that the whole thing is going to happen again because the same risky bets with other people's money are bound to continue. Hmm.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Jeffrey Rosen. He's a professor of law at George Washington University and the legal affairs editor of The New Republic. He's written a fascinating, lengthy article, Why Brandeis Matters, The Constitution and the Crisis, appearing in the June 29 issue of The New Republic, and well worth reading. He's a guy who's well worth thinking about in 2010. And maybe we should try and make that book on the bestseller list again. Wouldn't that be something? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Please feel free to send an email, and that is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Tomorrow during this time period, Bill Nye, the science guy, will be joining us. Always a great program, so make sure you listen. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hello. I enormously enjoyed reading that article. I'm in 100% agreement with what Brandeis had to say about big government and big business. I hope you'll give me a follow-up later. The thing is, though, it's a wistful agreement because we have a particular political party in America that first made itself the party of government, and then it decided to make itself the party of big finance. And I'm talking about the Democrats. It was the Bill Clinton administration that concluded all these big trade treaties all around the world, you know, by names like NAFTA and GATT, and these treaties with China, you know, shipping so many of our American jobs abroad. It was the Clinton administration that eliminated the Glass-Steagall Act that prevented these dangerous combinations in the banking industry that made dangerous bets with other people's money. The Clintons removed that protection. The Clintons also deregulated commodities such as these derivatives, you know, including the credit default swaps, and essentially deregulated the hedge fund operations, even those inside the big banks. And then on top of that, when Hillary Clinton was a senator from New York, she voted for that law that deregulated the credit card companies and made it almost impossible to declare bankruptcy if you fell victim to what the credit card companies were doing.
All right, I'm going to hold you there, Rick, because we have a ton of people calling in. Why did all of that happen during the Clinton administration? Too cozy with Wall Street?
Yes, I think so. And the caller is absolutely right that the Democrats in the 90s were the party of both big business and of big money. Too cozy with Wall Street. Robert Rubin, Clinton's Treasury Secretary, after leaving, went on to head Citibank, which benefited from the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So all that is true. But it's interesting to think about the flip side. It's not like the Republicans were taking very different positions. The repeal of Glass-Steagall was championed by Republican Senator Phil Graham. The Republicans enthusiastically supported all of that deregulation of the financial industry. They've opposed the resurrection of Glass-Steagall in the current financial climate. And, of course, they haven't been tremendously small government-oriented either under George W. Bush and the post-9/11 national security state. Why is it that there's no Brandeisian party today? When you think about Brandeis's day, in 1890, there was no national constituency for trust-busting or for economic reform. But by 1912, the presidential candidates of both parties, both Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, were enthusiastic trust-busters in different ways. And I think that's because there was a grassroots movement, the progressive movement, mm-hmm. which really created support for this over a period of 20 or 30 years. That's lacking today, and maybe the reason that even the Democratic president isn't more sympathetic to Brandeisian rhetoric is because liberals have been more concerned with big business and less concerned with the dangers of big government, and conservatives are the opposite. They've been very pro-deregulatory in the economic sphere, but haven't been similarly sensitive to the dangers of civil liberties and intrusions by the state. So we just don't have someone who shares Brandeis's opposition to big government and big business, and maybe it's time for that movement to develop. There are some political figures today. Senator Al Franken, for example, has been very eloquent in opposing big business and in talking Brandeisian rhetoric. Elizabeth Warren, who's been nominated to lead the new oversight board, the Harvard Law professor, speaks some of this kind of rhetoric. So there are figures out there, and conservatives as well, but it would take a grassroots movement really to create a national constituency for this, and I think that's what we need right now.
Was Brandeis a buddy of Fighting Bob La Follette?
He sure was. Great question. And he admired him tremendously, and La Follette would come to Brandeis's teas, and they shared all sorts of advice, and Brandeis was definitely a hero of La Follette's.
Hmm. Thanks, Rick, very much for the call. We go to Bill from Boulder Junction next. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Excellent topic, wonderful discussion. He talks even more than most of my colleagues. I commend him and wonderfully articulate answers.
Who are your colleagues, Bill?
I'm calling myself. No, I'm kidding. but what I'm calling about is that it sounds like some of the lectures I had nearly 40 years ago in college. Is there a connection between, you know, Thoreau and Emerson and well, even Melville, something was called the antinomian heresy, where these writers really attack conventional wisdom or the structure of organized churches and said, you know, man has to look inside himself. Every man has to do this. The source doesn't come from orthodoxy. And I think there's a bit of, I'm not sure, but it seems that an intellectual tradition in a way is continued in Brandeis, but I don't know. That's my question. And the other is a comment about J.P. Morgan. I was there when they deregulated Glass-Steagall, and it made great sense, even though I was on the banking side. I was in J.P. Morgan Trust Company. It made great sense because Morgan was essentially doing all that in Europe anyway, underwriting U.S. companies, issuing bonds under the Eurodollar denomination, all the petrodollars that were locked up in overseas banks. And during the training program, they made a great point of saying that J.P. Morgan's caution was never make a deal with anybody you don't know. The last refuge of any credit is really the character of the person you're dealing with. And you had to know that. I mean, it's pounded into our heads that you really had to do your homework about who you're dealing with, none of which seems to have, at all levels of the Morgan crisis and the derivative crisis that we had, nobody, in fact, people looked the other way. They were told to issue these mortgages and don't worry about the numbers, and they were told to produce the numbers or they'd get fired. I have two sources that have confirmed that from relatives.
Professor Rosen.
Two wonderful observations. On the Thoreau and Melville and Emerson, you're absolutely right. In fact, at Harvard Law School, Brandeis was fired by Melville and Emerson and by the New England tradition, and no doubt that influenced his view. I don't know if it was antinomian strictly, but it was very much that each individual had a solemn duty as a citizen to be committed to small-scale communities and to elevate and improve himself. Brandeis had a very strenuous kind of Emersonian conception of leisure. He thought leisure was important. You needed time off from work, but you're supposed to use that leisure reading about the ancient Greeks and basically becoming a better person so that, you know, when you were doing the garment worker strike, you could quote Thucydides and basically understand the core of democratic principles. So he was not a favor of video games, let's just put it this way. And he wouldn't have been, he didn't like the idea of the consumer. He hated that word. He preferred citizen. And he was very much an Emersonian for just the reasons you say. As for Morgan, how interesting to hear your story and your experience with the Morgan Bank. I've just been reading, I'm in the middle of Ron Chernow's definitive history, The House of Morgan, and he also talks about how both J.P. Morgan and Pierpont Morgan insisted on character, just as you suggest, and that definitely helps in terms of avoiding reckless loans. On the other hand, there's a dark side to that. Morgan and his father were openly anti-Semitic, for example. They refused to make loans to Jewish banks, and as a result, they allowed certain banks to go down just because of personal opposition. They were really blinded by their prejudices. So there are downsides to character, although in the end, actually knowing the quality of the risks that you're underwriting definitely helps a lot. But yeah. Thanks for two of those really good observations.
Yes, thank you so much for the call, which brings us, as long as you mentioned this, let's talk about Zionism. You write in your piece, raised as an unobservant and non-practicing Jew, Brandeis experienced a remarkable personal and intellectual transformation in his 50s and became head of the Zionist movement in America. Let's talk about that transformation. What happened?
What an astonishing transformation.
It is, really.
It is. I mean, he said he was completely separate from the traditions of his people. He was chastised as a kid for going riding on Yom Kippur. His parents were unobservant. He never denied his Jewishness, but just didn't identify with it at all. Why did he change? Well, first there was this garment worker strike that I mentioned, and just seeing the intelligence and commitment of these Russian Jewish immigrants impressed him greatly, and also their commitment to Zionism. And second, he was interviewed by the editor of a distinguished Jewish newspaper, and the editor noted that his beloved uncle had been a devoted Zionist. This was Dembitz, who Brandeis revered so much that he took Dembitz as his own middle name. And when Jacob de Haas said Dembitz was a noble Jew, that also fired Brandeis. Huh. But he was just a master of organization, and when he was asked to chair Zionist meetings, he did so. And in the process, he transformed his conception of citizenship. Brandeis, like other German Jews of his day, had initially been suspicious of Zionism because they thought it would resist assimilationism. The idea of hyphenated Americanism was denounced by Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, and the idea is it would stop you from being a good American. Brandeis changed his views. He came to believe that Jews could become better Jews and better Americans at the same time, and that only by committing themselves to the Zionist principle, not necessarily moving to Israel, but supporting it as a community, then Jews would find the sense of commitment and identity that all Americans needed to develop their individuality. And he extended this idea of cultural pluralism, which he got from theorists like Horace Kallam, the great progressive thinker, to other groups, too. This was not an exclusive vision. He thought that Italians and Germans and Polish people, all by embracing their heritage, could ultimately be better Americans and better citizens at the same time. This was incredibly farsighted for its day. It was a time when Jews and others were anxious about their identity. It's amazingly relevant today in an age of multiculturalism and anxieties about identity, mm-hmm. where it both insists on allegiance to certain immutable American ideals, but also to cultivating the individuality of distinctive traditions. And it's just an inspiring story to see how much of a Jewish leader Brandeis became.
I like your sentence here that he himself said he had come to Zionism through Americanism.
Very much so. I mean, we can be better Jews by being better Americans. This was not just a parochial project, but it's also important to remember he saw in Israel the culmination, the fulfillment of the Jeffersonian shires and the Periclean polis that he so admired in his readings. Remember, he was a Jeffersonian, and he thought that only small-scale agrarian communities could fully engage citizens, and he visited Israel, saw the kibbutz, and saw the socialist agrarian project where people would work with their hands and study Talmud by day. And for him, this was the fulfillment of his idea of small-scale democracy. Mm. Now, you know, what he would think of Israel today is another matter. Israel has not developed in that sort of agrarian socialist direction that he prized. And you can criticize Brandeis for being a bit of an idealist in all this sense of equating Israel with ancient Greece, along the lines of his favorite book, by Alfred Zimmern, about the Greek Commonwealth, which is another good book that Brandeis fans might want to read. But for him, it was all of a piece and very connected to his idea of engaged citizenship on a small scale.
Hmm. So he may not be very happy with America these days either.
No, that's true. I think there's not a lot. Well, let's try to think about what he might be happy about. Should we talk about the Internet, maybe?
Of course, let's.
Okay, well, what would he think about the Internet? I wonder about this. You know, on the one hand, maybe he would view the explosion of chat and blogs and discussions as some kind of fulfillment of the small-scale participation that he thought was necessary for democracy to flourish, especially bounded communities where citizens are actually engaged in deliberating with each other, is in some ways a fulfillment of his vision. So maybe he would have been nervously optimistic about that. On the other hand, he would have been disappointed, but certainly not surprised by some of the excesses of the Internet, the polarization of speech, the anger, the mobs that can sometimes develop to try to enforce ideological orthodoxy. Brandeis was so devoted to reason and measured debate that some of the excesses of the net, no doubt, would have troubled him. But as in many things, he would have embraced new technology. He was so forward-thinking always, and in the Supreme Court opinion where he insisted on the need to translate the Constitution into the age of the radio, he anticipated the age of cyberspace. He said, ways may someday be developed by which it's possible to enter the home and extract papers from desk drawers without physical trespass. A far smaller invasion was unconstitutional in the age of the American Revolution. We need to ensure that the Constitution today protects privacy in this virtual age. And he had in his desk drawer a clipping of a remarkable new invention, namely television, but his law clerk persuaded him not to mention it because the guy thought it would be too science fiction sounding. So he was always eager to learn facts and to project himself into new technological eras, and he certainly would not have been a Luddite. He would have been clear-sighted about the benefits and costs of the Internet.
So the question is, would he have signed up for Facebook so we could deliberate with him, or would he have been worried about privacy issues?
That's such a great question. I think he would not have signed up for Facebook. He would have, as the author of the most famous article on the right to privacy ever written, he had a horror of unnecessary display. He was quite buttoned up about his private life, and he would have thought that people would do better, you know, reading ancient Greek philosophy than befriending each other. Someone asked me recently if Brandeis would have had a blog, and if so, what it would have been called. And I thought maybe dembits.com, because that was his middle name, and, you know, something like democracy bits. But I don't think he would have blogged. I don't think he would have blogged either, because this is a man who never allowed anything to go out under his name without 10 or 20 drafts. I mean, he was
Goodness. A
Econovite worker. His law clerks were required to stay up all night and to give him the drafts of opinions before he woke up, supposedly at 5 in the morning, and one law clerk slipped the thing under his door at 5 in the morning, and immediately a hand came on the other side and pulled it into the room because Brandeis had been standing up waiting for it. So he was very, very disciplined in all aspects of life. Mm.
Mike from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there? Mike is gone. We go to Al from, by the way, our number is 800-486-8655. And a couple lines are finally open if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@wpr.org. Hey, Al.
Hey, I just wanted to address the irrelevance of the Glass-Steagall Act from a free market perspective. Once you think that, you know, these big firms that are engaged in this risky behavior with other people's money, don't you think that if they were punished by consistent failures that, you know, they would either self-regulate or the people would put them out of business because of the hazard of their business practices?
Good question. So in other words, the real problem you're suggesting is too big to fail, not the combination of investment and commercial banking. And if there weren't this unspoken guarantee that the government would come in and clean up after people's messes, then they wouldn't take these risky bets to begin with. It's a fair point worth thinking about. It didn't quite pan out that way in 29, when there wasn't really the unspoken guarantee of government bailouts, but the banks still allowed individual investors to make these incredibly risky bets on margin because they were more concerned with share prices than with responsible behavior. So I think Brandeis would have said that it's size, not just the absence of government bailouts, that matters. If you have smaller scale banks, they'll have more of an incentive to make careful choices. But maybe it's a combination of all these things, the lack of the too big to fail guarantee, break up the banks, and also some you might not need a complete separation of commercial investment banking. Paul Volcker says the real problem is just this proprietary trading, and if banks were not allowed to make trades for their own account, you could allow commercial banks to engage in investment banking activities, but it wouldn't be so risky because they'd be dealing with smaller amounts of money. But it's a good question and well worth thinking about.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the New Deal and Brandeis and FDR. You write that he was willing to join some of the opinions striking down New Deal legislation. What were those, and what kind of relationship did he have with President Roosevelt?
President Roosevelt was slightly in awe of him, which, of course, Roosevelt wasn't of most people. Roosevelt would call him Isaiah after the Old Testament prophet.
Oh.
And they were, you know, they had a cordial respect for each other. But Brandeis became increasingly distressed by the centralization of the New Deal, which he thought offended principles of accountability, separation of powers, and the curse of bigness. So after joining a series of opinions, there were three opinions in the 1930s striking down aspects of especially the National Industrial Recovery Act, which Brandeis especially disliked because he saw it as a blank check from Congress to the president, which violated the non-delegation doctrine. Congress wasn't taking responsibility for the decisions it was making, but basically allowing the president to do whatever he thought was best to regulate the economy. Brandeis joined the unanimous opinions striking these things down, and then he called Tommy Corcoran, who was one of his former clerks and a friend of FDR's into his chambers and said, "You have to tell the president he's living in a fool's paradise. You know, we're not going to let him do this anymore." Brandeis very earnestly believed that enforcing these constitutional boundaries would be for the good of the country. But this is an important distinction. Brandeis was not enemy of the New Deal, and he strenuously dissented from many of the 5-4 decisions striking down other aspects of the New Deal and the NRA and so forth. And he was on the side of the liberals who eventually triumphed when the swing justice, Butler, changed to, Justice Roberts, no relation to the current Justice Roberts, changed his vote in a switch in time that saved 9 and upheld the New Deal. So Brandeis is a good cautionary tale for the Roberts court today. He would have been appalled by things like the Citizens United decision striking down campaign finance, which would have offended both his anti-corporate sensibilities and also his insistence on judicial deference. Brandeis was not in favor of striking down federal laws on the basis of narrow 5-4 majorities. Generally, he was very devoted to judicial restraint, defined as deference to laws passed by Congress and the president. And he really was one of the great defenders of liberal judicial restraint and thought the courts should generally get out of the way when the president and Congress were acting together. And in this respect, there's no Brandeisian on the current court, no one who's consistently devoted to judicial deference across the board, regardless of the political consequences. He's a good reminder for us in this regard, too.
An email from Gail in Roxbury. My favorite Brandeis quote is, "The most important political office is that of private citizen." Could you talk about that?
Beautiful quote. I'm so glad you found that, and what an inspiring quote it is. He thought there was no higher duty and responsibility and privilege in America than the status of private citizen. As I said, he distinguished that strenuously from consumer. He thought of consumers as sort of idle, passive people who are manipulated by advertising. Citizen is the opposite, and a citizen has rights but also duties. If you're a citizen, you have to stay up late and go on your beach vacation. You have to take all sorts of government reports so that you can learn about the latest productivity figures and make informed decisions about what the best policies should be. You have to use your leisure. You know, he wasn't a total totally doer. He liked canoeing and jogging. But, you know, if you're a good Brandeisian, you wake up in the morning at 5 a.m., obviously. You have a quick jog around the lake to get your mind going. And maybe until breakfast, you read some government reports from both America and Sweden. And then you can write to your representative and organize a strike or something like that. And then spend the afternoon maybe reading a little bit of literature just to improve your mind further. And then make sure you go to a speech at night and along with fellow citizens at the local political club, agitate for judicial reform or something like that. So it wasn't easy to be a citizen in Brandeis's vision, but he had such respect for the intelligence of ordinary people. He really thought that if given the chance, we would all live up to our best selves, and that's why he thought education was so crucially important as well.
So, Jeffrey, are you a good Brandeisian?
Oh, no way.
I think you are.
Who could live up to that standard? But just the more I learn about him, the more inspired I am.
I can
by
tell.
Him. And, you try to both personally and intellectually. He just gives us so much to try to live up to.
And you're writing a book about him now.
I am, and it's a book along the lines we're talking about. It's what does he mean today? What's his modern relevance about a whole range of issues? And I just find he's such a great guide for thinking of any hard issue that we have to think about now. He provides a lot of great guidance, so I'm learning a whole lot.
I'm sure, and I sense your enthusiasm and share it now. We've had several people wondering about the name of the book. We're trying to make it a bestseller again. It is Other People's Money. This isn't Jeffrey's. This is Brandeis's book, and Jeffrey's book will be forthcoming. And we'll do another show on Brandeis. I'm ready to do that. It's Other People's Money, Louis Brandeis's book, and How the Bankers Use It, published first in 1914. Time for it to be a bestseller again, I'm sure. Professor Rosen would agree. We're speaking with Professor Jeffrey Rosen this hour, professor of law at the George Washington University and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. His most recent book is The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. And he will, I'm not sure how long, but pretty soon come out with a book on Brandeis. Here's our phone number again, 800-486-8655. Some lines are open, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@wpr.org. So join us, as we would like to hear from you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Nye, the science guy, is with us tomorrow during this hour. All right, let's we got more phone calls coming in. Let's take an email from Adam. Can you ask Professor Rosen about Justice Brandeis's views of the Second Amendment in general and how he might feel about it today?
Good question. I think I'm tempted to Google, because there was a Second Amendment decision in the 1930s. I don't think Brandeis wrote separately on it, but basically I think Brandeis did not have occasion to confront the Second Amendment dramatically, but the decision that he joined recognized limited Second Amendment rights, and essentially he was a textualist. He would not have been the kind of justice to disregard a textually enumerated right. He was also very much in favor of states' rights and liked to defer to laws passed by the states. So especially the states passed gun control laws, he might have been sympathetic. You can tell from the fact that I'm not sure. I don't think it came up before him. But one thing I can say is that he was very keen on translating technologies and unforeseen circumstances, and he would never have said, well, if the founders took a certain kind of gun for granted, we have to approve of all guns today. He would have said, what's the difference between an assault rifle and the muskets that the founders took for granted? How are they used for different purposes? How can we preserve the liberty the founders meant to protect, while at the same time in this very new context? So he might have surprised us on the Second Amendment.
Yeah. So then you would call that kind of philosophy, what did you call it?
What did I call it? Living originalism? Because, originalists, those who are devoted to a jurisprudence of original understanding, say we should just look to what the founders thought and end there. And Brandeis would not have been satisfied with that. He did believe that it was important to start with the values that the framers articulated, which he thought were immutable and fundamental, but he always insisted on translating them into new and unforeseen circumstances. And that's why his greatest opinions did just that, that privacy decision was one where a majority of the court said wiretapping is fine. In the age of bootlegging, the government is trying to investigate suspected violators of prohibition, and they put wiretaps underneath the sidewalk in a bootlegger's house and eavesdrop on his telephone conversations. A majority of the court, led by Chief Justice Taft, says no trespass, no privacy violation. At the time of the framing, you had to break into someone's house to read their private letters. Here they didn't break into his office. It was public property on the street. No problem. Brandeis completely rejects this wooden and unconvincing conclusion. He says, at the time of the framing, you'd invade much less privacy by breaking into someone's house than you can today by listening in on a telephone conversation where you're violating the privacy not only of the bootlegger, but also of all the people that he's talking to. And in order to ensure that we don't have less privacy today in the age of radio and the wires that the framers did in the age of the horse, we need to ensure that the amendment protects not just places of physical trespass, but also persons, houses, papers, and effects, according to the words of the Fourth Amendment itself. And that's why he was willing to regulate wiretapping almost 50 years before the Supreme Court came around to his point of view. So that's why I called it living originalism, not undisciplined living constitutionalism that says that judges should make up rights. Instead, start with the language of the Constitution, look at the values the framers meant to articulate, and then translate them in a disciplined way into a modern world in light of new technologies. I so hope that our new justice, Justice Elena Kagan, who is succeeding Brandeis, she's actually holding Brandeis's seat. There have been only two justices that have held it since Brandeis. Brandeis was succeeded by William O. Douglas, then by John Paul Stevens. I hope Justice Kagan will follow Brandeis's model and will engage this project of translating the Constitution in light of new technologies. It would be such an exciting and worthwhile project to take up.
Yes. Ron in Milwaukee is your next caller. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. This is so interesting. There's so much. There's so much witness to corruption in both corporate money handling and in political activities, Cheney and Bush, and torture, and so much doubt, I think, by citizens concerning justice. What would Brandeis say about bringing the culprits to justice?
He would have been hell-bent on it. He was very keen on investigating corporate corruption. He made his name by looking into conflicts of interest that J.P. Morgan had in his efforts to take over the New Haven railroads. He very much supported the prosecution of dishonest corporate executives who were trying to line their own pockets with insider trading. And he would have been enthusiastic in trying to bring corporate malfeasance to justice, as well as analyzing the structural problems that lead congresspeople to be in the thrall of lobbyists and that lead both political parties to be in the pocket of big business. And the fact that he would have used language like this, you know, in a mainstream way, in a way that didn't prevent him from being on the Supreme Court, shows how much our political discourse has changed, where it's considered some sort of fringe thing to talk about corporate corruption, prosecution, and accountability in this way. So he would have been very sympathetic to your concerns.
Thanks, Ron. Peter in Minneapolis. Hi, Peter.
Well, good morning, Professor. I read your book on privacy where you held up Monica Lewinsky as a hero, and I agree with your tenets there. I have a question on that subject. Would Justice Brandeis, or do you equate the right to privacy with the right to self-determination? What differences would you see? And you did address my question about technology to a great extent. So my question is Justice Brandeis ever as to the nature of money? Because he took his seat right after the year after the Federal Reserve Act was enacted.
Wow, two great questions. First of all, thank you so much for reading the privacy book and for remembering Monica Lewinsky, who was my privacy hero in the 1990s, and thanks for asking what Brandeis would have thought about that. What an important question. So Brandeis writes the most famous article on privacy ever written in 1890, and he's worried about new technology, namely the Kodak camera and the tabloid press that leads aristocrats like him and his law partner to be gossiped about in the Boston Society papers. And he proposes a new right of privacy. And you say, is that a right of self-determination? It's hard to identify what the right was. I mean, he talked about the right to be let alone, but it wasn't really that. What he was really talking about was the right to control your own image, not to be gossiped about or talked about against your will. What would he have made of the age of Facebook? My goodness, the kind of mild society gossip he was concerned about, or even the stuff I was concerned about in the 90s with Monica Lewinsky, has multiplied exponentially. 500 million Facebook users, literally billions of tweets and status updates and photos exchanged every day. The scale of the problem is unimaginably larger than Brandeis could ever have anticipated, as I anticipated 10 years ago. What would the solution be? I wonder if Brandeis would have thought the main solution today is legal rather than technological. In an age when the web never forgets, when every bit of gossip about us is written down and indelibly recorded, the idea of creating new legal rights to allow you to sue people who gossip about you doesn't seem that realistic. I mean, some legal scholars have proposed it. You should be able to sue your Facebook friends if they share your pictures without your consent. I don't think that's very practical, and I also think it runs smack into the First Amendment, which Brandeis also cared about. For me, the most promising solution nowadays to this problem is expiration dates for data. Facebook could, if it chose, say, do you want to have that picture be stored forever, or just should it go away after 3 months?
Yes.
And if that sort of thing were implemented, then a lot of the problem would go away. Now, Facebook has chosen not to do that because of its corporate interests. They want to sell us ads based on the data, and they think they can get more precise ads if they own our photos and they keep them up forever. But I think Brandeis would have been very open to the possibility that technology rather than law might be the solution. And I just would have loved to see what he made of this problem, which, as you can tell, this is one of my favorite problems. I've just written a piece
in the
about
New York
this
Times.
Too, and, yeah, it'd be great fun to talk more about this. But thanks again for asking about Brandeis and privacy.
Obviously, a movement needs to be started by Brandeisians while they're on the beach during these remaining summer days, right?
Yes, and don't Twitter and don't use your iPhones to do Facebook updates when you're on the beach. You should be reading those government reports on your Kindle.
So when is the Brandeis book going to be released, Jeffrey?
I'm not sure. Frankly, about that PNR piece is about as far as I've gotten, but it's going to be a shortish book, so I hope to turn it in this year and maybe it'll be out late next year or just after that.
I look forward to it. Well, you've been the best possible guest. Thank you so much for being with us. You've got all these people in the Midwest ready to go and learn more about Brandeis. It's just terrific. Thank you.
Thank you for the great questions. And everyone who's listening, let's start a movement. Let's remember the curse of bigness, the danger of other people's money, and we will ensure that sunlight is the best disinfectant. So let's go get them.
Thank you. Jeffrey Rosen, what a marvelous guest. Professor of law at the George Washington University and legal affairs editor of the New Republic. He's writing a book on Brandeis right now, and he's a great guest, isn't he? Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Just a reminder, Bill Nye, the science guy, is with us tomorrow at 10. Thanks for listening. Great conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.